You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I am Jen Zaman, I'm your engineer, and I am sitting in for Judy Ansel tonight. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Millwrights Local 1529 and International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 124. Millwrights Local 1529 has supported labor and working class families for over 100 years. The International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We've been wiring Kansas City since 1905. If you're not finding your electrical contractor at IBEWlocal124.org, then you are not getting the best value for your money. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, we talk to David Van Arsdale about his book on temp work. It's a chilling look and argues that temp agencies should have been abolished with slavery or, at the very least, put under strict government control. He says they're super profitable traps of despair and poverty for the workers. Then, with tensions ratcheting towards war with Iran, Michael Zweig of U.S. Labor Against War gives us a historical working class perspective about how war with Iran threatens workers and our planet. In the news, did you hear about the general strike in Puerto Rico to bring down the governor? We didn't think so. And Nashville neighbors de-ice their community. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg, and we'll be talking about Son of Scalia. And now, here's the news. This is the news from our side, July 25th, 2019. This from PAI. Only a 20-year-old Justice Department ban on indicting a sitting president for any crimes while in office stopped Special Counsel Robert Mueller from indicting GOP President Donald Trump for obstruction of justice, Mueller told Congress this week. Testifying in a nationally televised four-hour hearing before the House Judiciary Committee, which is pondering whether to impeach Trump on one or more charges of obstruction, Mueller added that after Trump leaves office, he can be indicted for that offense. And Mueller reiterated at the beginning and throughout the session that his report did not exonerate Trump, as the Oval Office occupant repeatedly claims. Through repeated referrals to his report on both the Russians and the investigation itself, Mueller confirmed the obstructive efforts Trump undertook to stop the probe. They included ordering his former White House counsel Don McGahn to fire Mueller, and when McGahn refused and planned to resign, ordering McGahn to produce a letter for the record denying Trump ever issued the firing order. McGahn refused to do that, too. Other Trump obstructions included repeatedly trying to get his former Attorney General Jeff Sessions to retake control of the investigation about the Russians and shut it down, and to convince other witnesses to lie to Mueller's probers. Most of Trump's obstruction attempts failed because his underlings refused to obey his demands. One GOPer made the point that despite everything, Mueller's probe went ahead. Indictments were issued, and some Trump aides have pled guilty or have been convicted. That doesn't matter, two lawmakers pointed out, and Mueller agreed.
If you don't listen regularly to the news, then you missed a rare event this week for the United States, a political general strike. It accompanied a gigantic demonstration of up to 1 million Puerto Rican residents. That's one out of every three islanders who converged on the capital of San Juan on July 22nd to demand that embattled Governor Ricardo Rosello quit now. Their demonstration brought the island to a virtual halt, reports PAI Labor News Service. After 12 days of mass protest against him, Governor Ricky announced Wednesday he will resign on August 2nd. People are furious because of the leaked emails and conversations between Rosello and his inner circle, including two cabinet members indicted in a massive kickback and fraud scheme. The conversations show Rosello and 11 top allies disparaging and joking about the thousands of people who died in Hurricanes Maria and Irma more than 2 years ago and their aftermath. The Rosello's top financial advisor characterized the island's teachers' unions, who are Rosello's main opponents of his privatization of schools, as terrorists. One of the two indicted ministers was right-wing education minister Julia Calero, who is not a Puerto Rican native. She not only carried out the privatization drive, but she closed hundreds of schools while rigging millions of dollars worth of no-bid contracts for her cronies. The communications also disclosed sexism and homophobia by Rosello and his clique. Crowds of people dressed in black and waving the Commonwealth's flag jammed San Juan and shut down Las Americas Highway. Unions called the general strike and shop owners joined in. Puerto Rico's largest mall, the Plaza de las Americas, shut down both in solidarity and to prevent a repetition of the prior week's police tear gassing of protesters. They can't deny it. The power is in the streets, said outspoken San Juan Mayor Carmen Cruz, who President Trump has frequently insulted.
A group of neighbors in the Nashville neighborhood of Hermitage formed a human chain on Monday to protect a member of their community and his 12-year-old son as Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents sought to carry out an arrest. The incident, which was captured in a Facebook Live video, showed the neighbors surrounding the white van in which the man and his son had locked themselves. ICE agents driving a white pickup truck had blocked in the car in order to take him into custody. Stacy Farley, a neighbor who participated in the human chain, told BuzzFeed News the early morning standoff lasted about 4 hours. Eventually, ICE left and the neighbors were able to shuttle the two safely back inside their home. "We just wrapped our arms around and formed a chain and dared someone to break through it," said Farley, who lives three doors down from the family. Meanwhile, the neighbors encouraged them to stay strong and stay put, bringing them food and water. To withstand the intense summer heat, they also gave them wet rags and refilled their gas tank so that they could keep their air conditioner on. According to Nashville Scene, the ICE agents did not come with a warrant signed by a judge, which meant that they did not have the authority to forcibly enter the man's home or car. "They were here with an administrative order that they wrote themselves," Daniel Yoon, an attorney who was at the scene, told Nashville Scene. "There's no judicial review, no magistrate review, no probable cause. It doesn't give them the authority to break down a door like you would with a normal warrant. They didn't try to do that, but they still lied to the individuals inside and to people on the scene saying incorrectly, no, this does give us that authority."
On Wednesday morning, June 12th, 21 guest workers at the King Fuji Ranch in Mattawa, Washington, didn't file into the company's orchards as usual to thin apples. Instead, they stood with arms folded outside their bunkhouses, on strike, and demanding to talk with company managers. So writes David Bacon, the foremost chronicler of immigrant labor in the U.S. He continues, "According to one striker, Sergio Martinez, we're all working as fast as we can, but the company always wants more. When we can't make the production they're demanding, they threaten us, telling us that if we don't produce, they won't let us come back and work the next year. We want to speak with the company, so we're not working until they talk with us." The contracts under which the workers come to the United States in the H-2A Agricultural Guest Worker Visa Program allows employers to set up production quotas. They can fire workers for any reason, and fired workers can no longer stay in the country. In effect, getting fired for low productivity makes a worker subject to deportation. Employers and their recruiters are allowed to maintain lists of workers who are eligible for rehire, effectively a blacklist. The impact of this power imbalance has produced a long train of complaints of abuse, not only led to the King Fuji worker strikes and others like it, but also convinced the Washington State Legislature to pass a new law that seeks to enforce greater protections for workers. SB 538 promises greater protections for H-2A workers themselves, as well as for resident farm workers. Growers will pay application fees, and the funds will be used to set up an office tasked with monitoring labor, housing, health, and safety requirements for farms using the H-2A visa program, as well as prioritizing outreach to domestic farm workers prior to H-2A recruitment to make sure they're not being undercut by the guest worker program. Tonight's news was read by Jan Zaman, Chris Mann, and I'm Tom Gebkin.
Hello, this is Joyce McCauley, and today we're interviewing Dr. David Van Arsdale from Syracuse University, Professor of Sociology at the State University of New York at Onondaga Community College. His research commonly addresses issues of work and culture, economy and development, and race and ethnicity. His book, The Poverty of Work, Selling Servant, Slave, and Temporary Labor on the Free Market, goes inside the world of temping and discovers a type of work dreadfully insecure yet growing rapidly. The book illustrates how employment agencies moved from England to North America during the colonial period, where they sold workers into many deprived employment statuses, including indentured servitude and slavery. Today, left largely unregulated, employment agencies are powerful corporations generating astonishing revenue by selling flexible, on-demand temporary workers. So welcome to our show, David. And I'd like us to start talking about your book in the area of the history of temp work and how it got to the United States. It didn't just start here.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Joyce. I appreciate it. So the history of that is quite a lot older than many previous scholars have discovered. Employment agencies came to the United States really right from the beginning of the United States, back in the middle of the 1700s. In fact, I thought it was really interesting to discover that the tavern where the Boston Tea Party was organized also housed an employment agency. And in those days, employment agencies were called intelligence offices. And there's a whole history to why they were called intelligence offices. But just in brief, it really has to do with the fact that when the first employment agency in what I would call, mercantilism, or, the start of capitalism, the very first employment agency was a project of Henry IV in France, and that King Henry IV, and he hired a physician, Theophrastus Ranadou, who established an agency that trained, or that allowed servants some training, some job skills training, and allowed them to, to have a new master. And for so masters to come in and choose new servants, and servants could choose new masters. Anyway, the people thought this was the greatest thing. Of course, it was the start of the at-will employment relationship. But, they called it the intelligence office. people called it that because they were gaining intelligence at the office. And that office also went on to publish the first paper, La Gazette, which is still in publication in Paris. And what that the first paper did, La Gazette did, was it lifted the skills of the service. Anyway, it eventually went to London and it privatized there. It was no longer part of the state, but it privatized, and during colonialism it became very popular as a means for migrants to get work on colonial ships and in factories and colonial production, and it had success in that way during that industrial boom that was related to colonialism. So when it finally landed here in the colonial North America, it carried on that name, intelligence office, and that name remained in effect all the way until the early 1900s in the United States, and it just, it really exploded. It really, it was the intelligence office was the agency that supplied indentured servants, that supplied a lot of the industrial workers, a lot of immigrants from work in all kinds of industries, both men and women, but it really became strongly dominated by domestic labor by the late 1800s. And late 19th century, and that's when it started also to acquire a kind of egregious reputation here in the United States. And as that happened, it switched names and it became the Employment Agency. But so there's a little bit of a snapshot of the history.
I read some of that first, and then went back to the first of the book because the history part of it kind of fascinated me. Were they literally coffee houses where they met?
Right. So this is also, when we think of London, we think of tea.
Yes.
We don't think of coffee, right, in terms of their preferred form of caffeine. But in fact, coffee houses were very popular in London in the 18th century. And they were the places that where the trading of stock began. And, when you're trading the stock again, let's say, for example, maybe you wanted invest in a colonial ship. You might buy a percentage of the ship, and then that stock would come back, and then you would own a percentage of that stock. And so then with that, what ended up happening in these coffee shops is that, they also started trading the workers and intelligence offices, as stock came in to produce goods from the stock. You could buy laborers, for the manufacturing process of stock in the coffee shop. So the relationship between coffee shops and intelligence offices is one that comes to New York and to colonial North America in much the same way it was in London. So you'd often find, New York City coffee houses and intelligence offices really close in quite close proximity to each other, both in Boston, New York, Philadelphia.
Interesting. So we're going to fast forward up to our current situation. And can you tell us how these agencies operate? I know that you worked with the Abelman organization and to follow them and see exactly what happened. Let's see, some of the things we could look at are how they operate, what the caliber of workforce was, because it sounds like there were some really skilled people that, work within these agencies.
Right, so that's a pseudonym, just to be clear, and I do use pseudonyms for the agencies that I worked for.
Okay.
Yeah, because, obviously the workers that I interviewed gave me a lot of information, and I never wanted in a particular agency to be able to decide who one of the workers was and therefore not, render work to them, when they see through them. So just to protect their privilege to work, I use pseudonyms. Excuse me. The workers are skilled. One of the things to kind of keep in mind is that employment agencies in the early 1900s, really did earn a considerable reputation in the United States. And union fought against them with success. They created the hiring hall as an alternative, all sorts of community organizations, benevolent societies, churches, really rallied against the model of brokering, selling workers as a means of making profit. And as they gained an egregious reputation, there was two major Supreme Court cases about whether they should even be legal entities. It was in the 1940s and 50s that really there was a name switch. That's all that happened. They became employment agencies and they corporatized. There are many examples, from Manpower to Kelly Services, but some of the early employment agencies that really corporatized and became the employers. They acted like employers for whatever company was hiring their workers. And this model is the model that today we call temporary help.
Okay.
It's exploding. It's very large. And the workers that you're referring to in this question are workers that work within that industry. And in the towns that I worked on job sites with them, most of the time they were laid off industrial workers who had worked in the industry for a long time, who had lost work, couldn't find a job in that industry anymore. So it would be very common for them to be either very young, 19, 20, 21, or not able to find work because of educational reasons, or ex-industrial workers in the 40s, 50s, early 60s, not old enough to retire and needing work. That was sort of common, the bifurcation in the population. And so they would move from job to job through temporary help companies.
Mm-hmm.
And their circumstances are often quite depressing because they want a lot more from work, and they work hard. They show up at these agencies at 5 or 6 in the morning, ready to be dispatched. Sometimes they wait for hours to get a job. Sometimes they might wait days to get a job. But they're there, Paul, waiting to be dispatched. The thing that always struck me as a legal quagmire is, there they are on call for flexible capitalism. They meet the demands of flexible production. And there's no pay. There's no reward. There's no compensation for being on demand, on call, for waiting, to get dispatched to, whether it's garbage or production or carpentry or construction there's no reward for that, for being on demand. And that to me seems to be not only immoral, but I don't know how it can continue. I really don't, because you're there at the work site of the company that is providing them their paycheck. Companies, by the way, that are doing very well financially. And so it seems like a complete injustice that their labor time can be occupied. And I actually talked about this before, but Paul said that if your work time is being utilized in the production process, that leads in the end to the attempt at profitability, then you should be rewarded for that time. And it seems to me that the whole act is being denied to this whole class of workers that are on demand, waiting to be dispatched, yet only get paid if and when they are at a job site, exercising their labor on a job site.
The other thing that I noticed as they're in those they're waiting areas for, like you said, they could be there for days before they get chosen. And the other thing is, once they do get chosen, some of the workplaces aren't really safe. And I think the stat that you had was it was 2 to 1. They were twice as in danger of being injured on a job than their permanent counterparts.
That's right. There's an incredible documentary that's been made by David. Well, I don't want to say his last name wrong now, but it's called The Day's Work, and it's about this very issue, just how prevalent job injuries are for temporary workers and big workers. We really spotlight one worker in particular who was unfortunately killed on a job site. I think that's his first day of work. It's a movie that everyone sees.
Everyone should see, yeah. And when workers report, because they're supposed to be following OSHA regulations, I would think. And so when workers report, does that pretty much, that there's a problem, does that pretty much mean they'll never work there again?
It can mean that. This is the state we're in. I work through all kinds of agencies when I wrote this book. And, some of them are these big corporate entities where, they're owned by parent companies that own 9, 10 different brands of temp companies. Others are mom and pop shops that I call non-corporate employment agencies. It doesn't really matter whether you're dispatched to a job from a non-corporate or a corporate, insofar as when you get there, really you're just told what to do and you do the job. You're not given any training. They don't know your name. They don't really have any of your employment information. All of that's in the hands of the dispatcher, the labor broker, or the employment agency. And so, you show up at a work site and you're told to separate recyclables or to package potatoes or onions or to put down bricks on the street or you're just told what to do. You're not given any safety training.
Yeah.
Sometimes the bigger corporate agencies have got a little better at providing you with some protective gear. But sometimes you don't even get that.
The other thing that I noticed was the workers, in order to get actually a full-time week, have to string jobs together. And that has to create a lot of stress. And then they're getting poverty-level pay. It's not like they're getting a regular, good 40-hour amount of work, pay to do, when they finally do get paid for this work. It's pretty much poverty level. And then and then when they try and get a full-time job, they're told that, they can't get a full-time job, that full-time permanent people don't want them because they think that they are empathetic to work, which I don't understand that because if these folks want to work that badly, that they wait for a job and obviously they are into, work and, doing what they need to do to support families and everything.
I think right now we're to a point where the employment regulation within industry has been so deregulated that most of the companies that I've worked for years, they really are used to hiring workers when and if they need. And they can get them from the agencies of their choice for the most part. And if they don't like an agency, they may go with somebody else. I mean, really, they do some agency sampling, to figure out who's going to supply their on-demand workers. So they're not, and a lot of these industries, they're just not, they don't want to hire full-time workers. For a lot of the folks who want full-time jobs, of course, this is a real problem. I should say, it's always worth reminding people that while I focus on industrial and light industrial employment, most of my book, which is the bulk of work for temp and gig workers, that there are really high-end temp workers and gig workers too. I mean, on the pay scale, there are folks with college degrees and tech jobs and medical in the medical field and and then computer programming, whom are also tests and make good hourly wages, but still aren't full time, and still don't, you know, have the sorts of security and benefits of a full time gig. So, but one can, as a test, make, you know, 30, 40, sometimes 50, depending on how high tech, dollars an hour. But for the most part, I think it's 60, 65 to 70% of all temp workers, industrial in the state, near minimum wage.
Yeah, yeah, that's what. We're running out of time. I wish we could go another 15 minutes, but we're about down. I just wanted to ask you one more thing. The book was published in 2016. What's changed since then surrounding this industry?
You know, right now, everybody's talking about the gig economy. And one of the things I like to remind anybody who's willing to listen is that this is just a new term that's really driven by the industry itself. And the industry in its history over really the, you know, since the beginning, the last 250 years, as an agency or as a, you know, an industry of temp acquires an egregious a reputation, there's a name change, and it's just a little slick move, you know, to kind of obfuscate our attention, our criticism. And right now there's one that's happening. We were talking about temp workers and temp workers, and temp became a bad thing, and so now we're talking about gigs. Right, and a lot of the new employment agencies that are run through apps, they're just virtual waiting rooms of workers waiting through their apps. That's all. It's the same thing. They operate the same way. They supply workers the same way. They give the same wages, rights, privileges, etc. And a lot of the agencies in the industry, they use the word gig in their name, and really that's a name that's been. It's come out of the industry. It's the temp work. It's the same thing.
Yes. Yes.
So that's something I think we should keep in mind. Gig is not necessarily new. The temp agencies all have their online platforms. I mean, you know, everybody's getting ready for the storefront. And this is the era we're in. I mean, storefronts are going away, and everything's going online. Well, same thing with the waiting rooms of employment agencies. They're going away. They're going online. And you know, you wait by your phone or by your computer, and you got to have the app, which really does disadvantage the poorest of the workers.
It does.
Who don't have phones and don't have computers, and therefore can't get access to the app.
Exactly, and that's what. I guess we'll have to end it here. But thanks a million for sharing with us, and you know, have a great weekend, and hopefully we can talk some more about this, because we could certainly do another show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And I just wanted to say that the book was revised in 2018 when it was published with Haymarket Books. So there is a little bit more of an updated version with Haymarket.
Oh, I'll look for that. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Melinda Tuhus traveled to the Arizona and Mexico deserts to interview refugees and Good Samaritans about what asylum seekers are fleeing from and what they face when they get here. Hear the fruits of her labors on Wings Saturday afternoon at 2:30.
Would you help the annual Global Ties KC program build international relationships by home hosting a student leader in Kansas City? The Global Ties KC program provides a link between international students with proven academic excellence to their area of professional interest. As a host, you'll extend that experience by providing home accommodations Saturday, July 20th through August 1st. For more information, visit globaltieskc.org/homestays.
Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind disks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy.
You play with my world. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the second half of the Heartland Labor Forum. The song we've just heard was Masters of War by Bob Dylan. And in the song, he writes that the masters of war that build all the guns, that build the death planes, that build all the bombs, that hide behind walls, that hide the masters of war then hide behind desks and hide behind walls. Unfortunately, our topic tonight is war, the war threats against Iran. Fortunately, we have a terrific unionist and social justice fighter and internationalist with us on the phone. He is Michael Zweig, a co-founder of U.S. Labor Against War. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me. Hello there.
Hi.
Hello, Kansas City.
Yes, yay, Kansas City. In an article published by David Swanson entitled War on Iran, the Stupidest Idea Yet Recorded in a Human Brain, David Swanson, executive director of World Beyond War, writes, Iran is nowhere near the United States. It has no ability to attack the United States, has not started a war in literally centuries, and spends less than 2% of what the United States spends on war preparations. Is this all true?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And so you founded U.S. Labor Against War. Why?
Well, U.S. Labor Against the War, it is not against war overall as a pacifist organization, but it's U.S. Labor Against the War, and it started in 2003 in the run-up to the Iraq War, which also has bearing on Iran. The U.S. Made up these reasons of weapons of mass destruction and important to defeat Iraq and to take out Saddam Hussein. And so what happened was, in the run-up to the war, a number of people in different unions and labor activists and labor leaders around the United States thought it would be important to oppose that war even before it started. And so the first meeting of people to think about putting something like that together was in January 2003. And then after the war started, we continued to try to develop that work inside the labor movement and bring the labor movement into the peace movement and the peace movement and peace issues into the labor movement. And the founding meeting of U.S. Labor Against the War was in October 2003 in Chicago at a Teamster Local, 705 in Chicago. And we built up to 160 different locals and central labor councils and state federations across all the country, across all different professions and union types to oppose American militarized foreign policy. And we're still at it and still doing work to oppose the enormous military budget and the military-industrial complex that has captured our government and is now talking about spending way over half of the discretionary money that comes to the federal government just on military, while the rest of our needs are being starved out in transportation and in education and health care and on and on, housing and so on and so forth. It's just horrible what's going on. And it concerns American workers, of course, and the American labor movement is very much involved in trying to put a stop to that.
So can you explain, and I understand you were in Iran in 1980?
That's correct.
Can you explain briefly about the history of the United States and Iran, their relationship?
Well, It's an important history that the Iranians know very well, and the Americans know not at all, or hardly at all. Iran, as David Swanson points out in that piece, has not initiated any war anywhere, has not invaded any other country for over 200 years. And the Iran-Iraq war that started in 1980 was initiated by Iraq, not by Iran. And the United States had a relationship with Iran after World War II in conjunction with the British to secure the Iranian oil for the United States and for Britain. In 1953, there was a democratically elected government run by a man named Mossadegh, who was, as I say, democratically elected. No one challenges the fact that he represented the Iranian, the will of the Iranian people, and he was involved in trying to nationalize the Iranian oil fields and drive a harder bargain with the British. He didn't want to take the oil away from the British or the Americans. He just wanted to have a more equal trading relationship. And as a result, the British and the Americans overthrew his government, and the United States planned that coup in 1953 in the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. And the Mossadegh government was overthrown, and the Shah of Iran was put in. And he was a so-called modernizer, but his modernization involved the very harsh repression of the Iranian people and the sort of selling out of the Iranian national treasures of oil and the resources to the U.S. and to Britain. So the overthrow of the regime, of the Mossadegh regime, and the putting into power of the Shah of Iran was something that was very traumatic for the Iranian people, and they developed a resistance to the Shah and wanted to overthrow and to get rid of the what they thought of as an illegitimate regime that came to power on the basis of American arms, American military, American CIA, and the British. And that resistance developed from 1953 forward until the revolution actually happened in 1979. Now, in the process of that resistance, the Shah, with American backing, brutally repressed any opposition. And the one place where they had a very hard time exercising total control and total repression was in the mosques. You know, it was just not so easy to go in and just kill off the imams because of the tremendous power of the of religious sentiment. Just like you couldn't think in the United States, you could think about, you know, assassinating Black Panthers, but you couldn't think about just going in wholesale assassinating Black church leaders. It just it's just a step too far. So in Iran in the 1960s and 70s, in the resistance to the Shah and to the United States, these religious institutions took increasing authority and increasing power because they were relatively, not completely, but relatively protected from these harsh repressive measures. So by 1979, there was a successful revolutionary uprising that was led by the Ayatollah Khomeini, who was, of course, a major religious leader and figure. And he was able to make tape recordings in Paris and then smuggle those tape recordings, copies of them, into mosques all across Iran and became a principal leader and propagator of the sentiments of revolution against the Shah and against U.S. Interests and U.S. presence there. So when the revolution happened in 1979, in February 1979, all kinds of people came forward in the political process, including a lot of leftists who had been repressed by the Shah, but with this new revolutionary upsurge, democratic forces and non-religious people and sort of bourgeois Democrats and Marxists and Trotskyists, all different kinds of people were free to express themselves and to participate in the political process for the first time since 1953. And in November 1979, about 10 months after the revolution that overthrew the Shah, the group of Iranian students went into the American embassy and captured that embassy and took hostages. That's a very famous story of American hostages being taken in Iran in 1979. That was in November 1979. And in January 1980, 2 months later, I was in Tehran as a guest of the Confederation of Iranian Students. I'd been working with the Iranian students here in the United States in opposition to American assistance to the Shah. And so when all this revolutionary activity and the challenges to the Shah resulted in revolution, and they took the American hostages, the students took American hostages, I got invited with Jim and Eva Cockcroft, the three of us, to go as a kind of fact-finding mission. And we spent a couple of weeks in Tehran in January 1980. Well, that was extremely interesting. When we were there, it was a time when there had been an election for president, a new Democratic election, and a secular Democrat with a small D, Abulhassan Banisadr, was elected president. And when we were there when his inauguration was happening. We went to that inauguration. There were all kinds of leftists out. There were the Trotskyists. There were the Marxists. Bookstores were out on the streets selling all kinds of, progressive and radical and revolutionary secular literature. And, of course, the religious people were there, too. But at that time, Khomeini said, well, we don't want to, the imams and the religious leaders, we don't want to have political power. We just want to be the conscience of all this revolution. And they allowed this democratic reform to happen. Well, it didn't take more than a year beyond that they did assert, the imams and the religious establishment did assert themselves in the political process. And then some further repression happened where the left was marginalized again and the secular forces were marginalized. They weren't necessarily totally imprisoned, but their political influence was certainly marginalized, and we see that up until this day. Yeah. Okay. Now, one thing that I'd like to point out that I think is important is that we in the United States tend not to know too much about that history. But the Iranian students took that embassy in November because in 1953, the embassy was the center for the counter-revolution against Mossadegh. And they were afraid that the embassy was still being used as a location for the plotting of the American undoing of their revolution. And so they wanted to take that embassy and make sure that it could not be used for that purpose. Mm-hmm. That was their thinking. Yeah. And when we were in Tehran, we met with those students. They wouldn't let us meet with the hostages. We told them that we thought it was important for them to release the hostages, that keeping the hostages would only inflame the situation and make it much more difficult for American people to see what was really going on. But the students there were absolutely adamant that they were going to keep those hostages. And they did, but
was resolved, the hostages were returned.
Well, that's an interesting story too. But for a moment, let me just finish up with this thing about who remembers what. I think of it like this: most people in this country, most kids and people, know of a bully who, when they were in school, they were in the 12th, in the fourth grade, and there was some bully on the playground who came and beat them up or stole their lunch money or something. Most people have that experience. You never forget that bully. You never forget who came and took your lunch money, ever. But I bet you that the bully doesn't remember that he took your lunch money. He probably doesn't remember that 2 days later because he's off doing something to somebody else.
Correct, yeah.
The U.S. is like that bully. We go around the world bullying all kinds of people, the Iranians, the Iraqis, the people in Guatemala, the people in Korea, and those people remember forever what the U.S. has done. Where the U.S. has memory lapses every day as to what we've done 2 days earlier to people all around the world. Now, the thing about the hostages finally being freed is really an interesting story, especially in the era of Trump and, you know, cooperation with Russia. Did he, didn't he, you know, collude with a foreign power in the election, all that stuff. Well, who really did collude with a foreign power in demonstrated and documented ways was Ronald Reagan in the election campaign against Jimmy Carter in 1980. Reagan was involved in trying to make sure that the Iranian hostages, that the American hostages would not be released until he got into power.
Oh,
and that
gotcha.
Was the deal.
Yeah, to make it look good.
And to make it look like he was the one who freed the hostages. And that's exactly what happened. And that was all negotiated during the campaign, an open negotiation between the Reagan campaign and the Iranian authorities to hold those hostages until he got there.
I totally agree with you. And we want to thank you for being on. Michael Zweig, founder of U.S. Labor Against War. Michael is an author, retired professor, and union activist. So thanks again, Michael, and we'll have you on for a longer show. Everything has changed. My world is ending. Everyone I knew are now gone. Airplanes in. Suddenly I can't hear anymore. I see kite, I see people running, I see bombs blowing up my precious country. I see blood, I see tears, I see children running in cares. I see you.
And it's time for Washington Window with Mark Gruenberg. I'm Tino Scalisi. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be on.
So it looks like Trump's going to be nominating Eugene Scalia for his next labor secretary. Can you tell us a little bit about this fellow? We've heard the name before, the last name. Can you tell us about this guy?
Yeah, Eugene Scalia is the son, one of the sons of the late Supreme Court Justice Tony Scalia. And the best way of describing him was by one labor lawyer I talked to who knew of a case that he argued against workers in Maryland. And it wasn't before the Supreme Court, but this is where Eugene Scalia comes down, quote, as bad as dad, unquote.
Oh, wow. So,
which should tell you everything you want to know about Eugene Scalia. He's a corporate lawyer. He's argued against workers at every level, and now Trump wants to make him the labor secretary in charge of enforcing laws affecting workers.
So this sounds like it sounds just like the kind of guy that we would have as the head of the Labor Department. Wow. So
he's terrible in so many words.
All right, so he's terrible in so many words. Can you give us a few of those words? We've got about 2.5 minutes here. Can we talk a little bit about this? Do we think that is there any question about whether or not he'll be confirmed? What's it looking like?
Unfortunately, the way the Senate has changed the rules, he probably will be confirmed because all you need is a simple majority. You can't talk him to death. You don't have a filibuster anymore. All they need is 51 votes, and they got 53, unless you find something really bad and a couple of the Republicans defect. But so far, with most of Trump's nominees, that answer has been no, and Trump has gotten his people in the courts, and now this would be in the Labor Department as well. So we're going to talk. We're going to marshal what we can. Unless there's something that's really god-awful to the rest of the country outside of working men and women, look for him to be confirmed, I hate to say.
Oh, wow. I remember back in the day, what was it, Puzder? That's the one. I thought that was bad.
Puzder, you know, got kicked out. He never got the nomination because of his attitude towards women.
Okay.
You know, in the... And we know about Acosta and how he was facilitating this serial sexual predator.
Sure. Yeah.
But
you're talking about Epstein.
So far, nothing like that has jumped up against Eugene Scalia yet. So far.
So the only really bad thing is that he's a corporate attorney who's taken the side of U.S. Capitol every single time and has voted against workers
right.
whenever he's had an opportunity, and he's fought tooth and nail for the business interests of this country. Well, that's it.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, one reason that the Trumpites wanted Acosta out was that Acosta, in their telling, was slow-walking pro-business deregulation.
Oh, wow.
In other words, he wasn't moving fast enough
wow.
to basically clobber the workers and go for big business.
So
this guy would be expected to go hell for leather.
So Scalia will be a faster stepper compared to his predecessor then. All right. Well, Mark, it looks like we're getting ready to wrap up here, and thank you so much for joining us on the Heartland Labor Forum.
Okay, you're quite welcome. Talk to you next month.
Talk to you next month.
And that's about it for tonight's show. Next week on the Heartland Labor Forum, it's the next auto contract. Is the UAW a house divided? I have been Jen Zaman, and Judy will return next week. Thanks for listening.
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.